Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, where we've had to make the difficult decision to stop providing a free podcast license to our over 75 listeners. Government cuts are to blame, we are sure that you understand. Hello, I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me it's Sean Pattenden, the Titanic share to my somewhat disposable Sonny. How are you, Sean?
Crikey, I'm all right, thank you, Andrew Harrison.
Are you liking our lovely new studio in Soho Radio in Broadwick Street?
I think we're going to get chucked out in a minute because it's too good for us.
It's nicer than my house by a mile.
Much nicer than my house.
It's got a lovely smell to it. We should put the podcast out in smell-o-vision.
It's like a lovely bar.
It is like a lovely bar. You were on one of those BBC story offs this week, weren't you? Story of 1988.
It certainly was.
Is this a brand new one?
It is a brand new one, yes.
Did they come to you with a narrative on these things and go, it was the year of X, please explain why?
Almost. Well, they say, here are the songs. You get all this Top of the Pops up front. So there's a whole Dropbox full of Top of the Pops.
Really?
Yeah, and you spend an evening watching 1988 Top of the Pops. It's really brilliant. Have a beer. It's like a party in your house. It's really good. So they say, this is what it is. What do you think? And obviously you don't want to... They give you some pointers, but you don't want to follow their narrative. You say what you thought about it at the time. It was very, very bouncy, 1988. It was really squeaky clean, a lot of asexual female pop stars, and then you get goth, and then you get acid house. So it all melds together. It's quite an interesting year. I quite enjoyed just thinking about
it. Still available on the iPlayer, no doubt.
It is still available if you really do want to watch it.
I do think it's quite ironic that we thought that this was the beginning of the time when we could watch all the Top of the Pops forever and ever. And actually, it turned out to be the last time to watch Top of the Pops because they're all full of Yew Tree.
Absolutely. The ones that haven't been binned by mistake as well. There are many, many unwatchable ones. The BBC banning itself, as usual.
Terribly depressing. We have two special guests this week. Claire Biddles is a writer on music and film for The Wire, The Line of Best Fit, Little White Lies, Dazed and elsewhere. She's a zine maker who's interested in fandom and the relationship between pop music and real life. I didn't know there was one. She co-wrote a documentary on mental health and screen culture called Sad Girl Cinema, and she recently tweeted, 13 years in Scotland, and I still automatically think MSP means Manic Street Preachers rather than Member of Scottish Parliament. So do I. Who doesn't think
yeah,
that?
Yeah, honestly, it's very confusing living in Scotland.
Welcome to Big Mouth, Claire. How are you doing?
Hello. Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
What is Sad Girl Cinema then? Tell us about it.
So it is a documentary about mental health in screen culture, so TV, film and music videos. And we're sort of looking at different themes of that, like from the kind of tragic artist to depictions of therapy on screen and things like that. So we're sort of doing a deep dive into all that stuff.
Well, possibly Killing Eve will be relevant to that one.
Yes.
We talk about, you also write about fandom, and fandom has been magnified a thousandfold by digital culture, hasn't it? People spend all day talking about their one favourite thing.
Yes.
You can now be a fan 24/7. Is that like now becoming people's main identity? They think of themselves as a fan of X first before anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's definitely something that you see on... in online spaces like Twitter, Tumblr, things like that, because people can kind of have a separate identity for their, like, a separate Twitter account for their, like, fandom and then their, like, normal life or whatever. So it becomes very kind of split personalities almost.
Interesting.
Returning to Big Mouth this week is Will Hodgkinson, rock and pop critic for The Times, author of The House is Full of Yogis and Guitar Man, in which he learns to play the guitar from scratch, quite difficult, and without a doubt the regular guest that most resembles Al Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
Hello, Will. How are you
doing? Al Cooper.
We still notice. We're still going to search more pictures out. It's a constant parade of excitement for you working for The Times. In the past few weeks, you've interviewed John Grant, Keane, who are back.
Keane, yeah.
And Amel and the Sniffers. Who were the most fun?
Amel and the Sniffers, without a doubt. What a surprise.
More fun than Keane. I don't believe it.
I tell you what, John Grant was the best interview.
Okay.
He was fantastic.
He's a good chap.
Yeah, he's amazing. Mm. I mean, I love him. I think he's an incredible guy. He was in Iceland. He was a journalist's dream. He is somebody who wants to do an interview, which is quite rare. And he loves to talk. You know, yeah. I mean, the interview went on for about 2 hours and I said, okay, yeah, I think we've got it. He's going, well, is that it? Which never happens. So he was great. Keane was actually very, very nice. I mean, they are what you probably think they are. They're nice middle-class boys from Sussex. Mm-hmm. So and they were very sweet. And actually, they, in their own way, had terrible problems. And so Tim Rice-Oxley had this drunk driving accident, incident. He'd had gone through a divorce. And so all these different things which you sort of don't associate with a band like that.
Yeah.
So they were very, very nice. Mm. Amel and the Sniffers were just hilarious.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Amy Taylor, the chief, basically, the one who's in control, she was talking about all the other guys, and they're all in the room at the time, and she was saying, yeah, he's, you know, he's a bit of a diva, and he thinks he's a rock star and all this sort of stuff. And so I said to them, you know, they didn't get a look into the interview. And then I said to them, so what do you think of her? And they went, lovely.
They're under strict orders.
Oh, they really were.
All right. Who would be most terrifying to go on a night out with? You
know? Well, I did go out on a night out with Ammon the Sniffers. And it was terrifying. We ended up in this some biker bar in Germany, yeah. And you know, and I realised, you know, I'm coming up to 50. Mm. They are in their mid 20s, and they're just like, I mean, they is just, you know, just booze, but
yeah,
yeah.
They can hang on then.
They can do it, and I can't.
We believe you've also discovered AlgoRave, which is rave plus algorithms. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was fascinating. That's actually a very idealistic movement. It's the whole thing behind it is that these algoraves control us. So, you know, we've all done it. You know, you do a search for something and then all of a sudden you're getting, you know, kind of vaguely related things, yeah. In a scary way.
Yeah, yeah.
So their whole thing is, well, actually, algoraves are just these codes which aren't as complicated as everyone thinks. So we can build the algorithms ourselves. Mm. And in their case, they're making music with it. I have to say, the music was kind of unlistenable, but it was fascinating, and I really like the people involved, and I like their whole spirit. And also, they call it open source.
Right.
So it's actually, okay. It's sort of anti... I guess they've all got PhDs. They're not like necking ease and, you know, yeah. Like doing...
Necking ease and PhDs. I like it.
I think you can do both together, actually.
Yeah, maybe.
So what happens if you Google algorave? Chaos.
You'll get algorave.
Anarchy.
Exactly. You'll get the algoravers. So, yeah, it's a very interesting movement. It's very anti-superstar DJ. They're kind of the opposite. Right. And it's also... The other thing they say is they're not actually DJs because they make the music live. And I said, well, how's that possible? They said, it's the same as somebody using a trumpet or a saxophone. You're live coding. So you're sitting there with a laptop coming up with this stuff, and they don't know what's going to come out. They have certain things which are the equivalent of riffs. So, you know, like a guitarist will know that they can go to E to G or whatever. Yeah. They have certain, but they don't, there's a huge element of random and chance to the whole thing, which is where it gets exciting.
Jazz.
It's kind of like jazz.
Yeah.
And it gets moments.
Algo jazz.
To dance to. It's very difficult because you have moments where everyone's kind of grooving to it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the whole thing falls apart.
Yeah.
And that's part of it.
Does it sound like the music you hear when you take the drug cake in the day-to-day and your Shatner's bassoon is shattered?
Well, having not yet to experience cake...
It's a made-up drug, Will. It's not real.
No, I am, yeah. No, Algorave was great. It was the idea that fascinated me more than the music. The music is kind of... It's interesting, but pretty hard to listen to.
Is there a point where the Times boss just says... Who on earth are Ammon and the Sniffers? Or do you just get free rein to put all this amazing stuff in the Times?
I just have to do some pretty big mainstream stuff as well. And they let me get away with Ammon and the Sniffers every now and then.
This week on the show, we're looking at the return of Killing Eve, a.k.a. The Spy Who Came Out in the Cold. Does season 2 of the world's favourite bicurious tale of spies, assassins and expensive couture measure up? And can we get the word obsespionage into the dictionary? Also, Prince Originals, the late Imp of the Perverse, was famously generous in giving great songs to other artists. Now his first takes are compiled on a new album. Is it any good? And is it a good idea to present demos and sketches as a finished artefact? Plus, I Am Mother, new science fiction on Netflix. There's only one girl left in the world. She's being raised by a maternal AI. Will it work out? And where does it fit into the grand scheme of Last of Their Gender sci-fi works? Don't forget, you can get every edition of Big Mouth a day early by supporting us on Patreon. Help us to cover our studio costs by pledging us £5 a month, the mere price of a pint, and you'll get the show as soon as it's ready, plus the exclusive extra bit just for Patreon backers. This week we're choosing the most overrated and underrated movies of all time. And also, new Patreon backers on the £10 a month tier will get a free Big Mouth mug as well. Haha, so you can show off your education in the workplace and or home environment. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more.
OK, let us now throw ourselves under the bus that is the golden age of TV once again, as we start with the second series of Killing Eve, an adaptation of the Luke Jennings books. The first series, of course, was written by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, the Baroness It's OK to Like. Jodie Comer is back as Villanelle, the world's best psychopath, and this time she runneth towards Eve, played by Sandra Oh, not away from her anymore. Critics and viewers have been divided. Some say it's not as good as the first album, etc., with Waller-Bridge executive producing and not writing this. Someone called Emerald Fennell has taken over as head writer. But let's see for ourselves, shall we? We can't play the trailer without ruining everything, if you haven't seen it. But of course, it's the incredible soundtrack from David Holmes that makes the show. So here's a track from season 2, episode 1. This is his band, Unloved, with If.
If I loved you less, I'd be alive.
If I loved you more, I'd fade away.
If I loved you less, I'd be alive.
If I loved you more, I'd fade away.
Fun fact. Killing Eve was shot entirely in poor people's houses because Phoebe Waller-Bridge thought it would be funny. Sorry! Not true at all. Still can't get used to the related to the peerage thing. Right, we start with the end of the last series where MI5 agent Eve Pilastri has killed Villanelle after telling her she loves her because, you know, that's how MI5 works. Eve flees, as does Villanelle, and as such, the next game of cat and mouse begins. It's no spoiler to say that Villanelle isn't murdered by Eve at the end of the last series, although Eve thinks so. Will, are you a Killing Eve nut? And what did you think of this series?
Yes, I am. And I think it's all, I think for me, and I think in our family, so our son hates Killing Eve.
Okay.
Our daughter loves it. My wife loves it. I love it. The second series opened, the first episode was a bit boring, I thought. Mm-hmm. Not a great deal happened. But then... I don't want to give too much away because we've watched, I think, four of the new season, so yeah. I won't give too much away. But we are watching it. Just a quick aside, because I think it's all about Jodie Comer and Villanelle being such a magnetic performance. We're watching it last night, and Pearl, my daughter, said, "Oh, I love that outfit. It's Alexander McQueen with a Chloe jacket." It's like, how do you know? And apparently, there's a whole Instagram Killing Eve outfits thing,
yeah,
which I think is actually a big part of the appeal of the show. She's mm-hmm. really stylish. Mm-hmm. She, you know, this whole thing is that she's this psychopath that loves life.
Yes.
She loves clothes. She wants to make the most of every moment. You know, it's all that kind of stuff. So I think for me, the appeal, I mean, again, without giving too much away, there are some fairly unbelievable plot twists or moments mm-hmm. in the second series. But I think really the appeal is in her. You know, yes, it's just the charisma and the kind of joie de vivre of someone who also loves killing people.
Yes, there's I heard it's a Molly Goddard dress, is the pink one from series one yeah. that got everybody talking.
That's right.
And it was important to know that designer. So we're talking about layers of subtext. Do you not think that some of the Killing Eve has been formulaic in such as we have Jodie Comer? Yes, she's got all that charisma. And as you say, she is the world's best psychopath. She's really good at doing this. But almost everyone she's going to come in contact with, she's going to kill.
There is that. There's a boy.
Yes, we can sort of skirt around with the boy in the hospital.
Yeah, exactly. There's a boy who's had a very, very bad accident. He's lost his parents and he's severely disfigured. He's lost an eye. This is all without giving too much away. Mm. What came next, I have to say, surprised me. Now, you know, maybe everyone else guessed that it was coming, but I didn't guess it. So I'll just leave it there.
Okay.
So there's certain things that I didn't expect. Mm. There are other things which I felt were, you know, I think the main characters are wonderfully developed. The lesser characters are not so well developed. So Eve's husband could be really interesting, but you never really find out much about him. He's just a math teacher and he seems a bit boring, but he's clearly not boring. You just don't. I think it's just that he hasn't really, you know, the writers haven't really put much emphasis on those sort of secondary characters. It seems to have gone into Eve, Fiona Shaw's character,
Karen,
and Villanelle.
Yes, yes. Claire, are you a Killing Eve fan?
Yes, I really love it.
What did you think of series 2? Critics, as we say, were divided.
Well, again, I'm only on about episode 4, but so far I'm enjoying it. But I think I'm enjoying it more for the... It's kind of more of the same, because like you were saying, I think that it's more about the characters and about the kind of music and the atmosphere and the clothes and all these things. It's not really the plot is like not it's very twisty-turny, but it's kind of secondary for me. It's more like enjoying being in this world with these characters again. Mm-hmm. That I think I'm enjoying.
Fiona Shaw, who Will mentioned, plays Carolyn, the MI5 boss. We don't know what side she's on, and I think she's one of the characters that has been the most developed in series two.
Yeah, definitely.
What do you think of this idea of MI5 in the plot? Is it thick enough? Is this really what spies do?
I don't think it's.
Do
what
they
spies
get away with
do.
This?
But I don't think I think it would be less interesting. But I think that she is brilliant, and I think that a lot of the kind of intrigue comes from that we're really not sure where her loyalties lie. And there's a kind of moment in episode four where she says something like, "Oh, they've picked their side. You need to pick yours." And it's like, well, what's yours? It's very kind of, she's very interesting and gets some of the best lines in the whole thing as well.
Andrew, is this James Bond for today's mixed up kids?
I don't know any of today's mixed up kids because I'm old, but I binged this. I hadn't watched the first series. I binged a lot over the weekend, Friday night till Sunday night. Watched a lot of the first series, was completely swept away and felt, you know, being captain last with everything, I felt I was really not ahead of the cultural curve on this one. I should have been paying attention. What I really loved about the first series was it's a collision between Sandra Oh's dull world,
her
grey world, and this fantasist, as Will says, Villanelle is a psychopath who loves life, but she's also a fantasist and a narcissist, and her idea of, she thinks she's living in a musical, she thinks she's living in an amazing 1960s French street street dance routine fantasia where nothing matters.
Umbrellas of Cherbourg
with knives and but her murders have no consequence, and we see the consequence through Sandra Oh, who I think is fantastic, and I actually spending time with her more than I like spending time with Villanelle, because Villanelle is a self-created cartoon character. She's not a real person, and the genius of the character is she's smart enough to know that she's an empty individual. That incredible monologue where she murders—is it Fred, the guy with the guy's on the take in the first series?
Yes, that's right.
And she explains to him what death will be like as he's about to die. Is one of the most sadistic and terrifying and bleak and nihilistic things I've ever seen. So behind all the balloons and the lovely pink frock and Jane Seberg, you know, in a black and white movie. Yeah. She's actually a horrific abyss of a human being. Mm. And what I really like and find intriguing about the second series is, in the first series, we see Eve is pursuing Villanelle. And by the end of the first series, Eve has become Villanelle. She's become a killer. And now she's the prey.
Yes.
Now because she is a fully functioning human being with a network of friends and an understanding of morality and consequences, becoming that person is destroying her. And I think that is the fantastic aspect of it. Mm. It's very psychologically satisfying. I don't know what psychopaths are really like, but it kind of rings true.
Yes. That's what I think is the nub of this. And I think that's why I was trying to think, why is this so successful? Why does it get us? And it doesn't matter if you're a young woman, a very old man, you know, whatever it is, a circus performer. It's because Villanelle is the person that we want to be that we're not allowed to be. She is the id and Eve is the ego, and it's about this person, that absolute freedom of femininity, and it's about escape from domesticity. All the domestic scenes are, people argue in them, they're small and they're cramped, and Fiona Shaw displays, she is the freest person in it, because she has no side, she has a job, there's a quote where she says, you know, I don't know what a home is, or do you have a home, or something like that. She is clearly above everything. We're all trying to be Fiona Shaw, but it has all these psychological murmurings of what we really need to be.
She keeps trying to tempt Eve into leaving the world of the human race and joining her mad fantasy.
And I think that's why, I think it's deliberate that the husband isn't, the characterisation isn't that good on the husband. He needs to be really 2D. He needs to be a sort of pathetic character that doesn't really fit. It's all about these very strong women.
Yeah. And so there's a sort of dreary world, and then there's the fantasy world of Villanelle. It's true. I would also say there's been hinted at in the second season that Villanelle, she's slightly on the back foot, put it that way. You know, she's beginning to show little signs of, I suppose you could say, being in love is a weakness, you know, and there's a suggestion that she's in love with Eve.
Yes.
And that's is the first sign of a sort of chink in her armour, which I think is interesting. And it's kind of, you wonder where that's going to go with someone who's meant to be a kind of empty chasm.
Yeah, but also she is like a lot of characters in genre, and this is spy genre, but also within horror and superhero and all genre stuff. There are characters who are sort of supernaturally indestructible, and Villanelle is one of them. She can be stabbed in the gut and somehow not die.
Yes.
She can, missed
her internal organs, says the man at the hospital.
But more than that, she's the kind of character who, in this little podcast studio we're in right now, she could find something to kill you with and escape. She's operating at that level of supernatural, fictional character level.
It's like a computer game. Do you not think it goes in cycles and cycles, and it's like you're playing this computer game with these Teflon characters?
There's a great bit in series one where the husband says to Eve, you know, what's going to happen when you finish this level? But what's interesting to me in this is that you're seeing the collision of the real world and that fantasy world. And genre fiction, mature genre fiction now, is all about how awful it would be to be in this stuff. You know, when you're reading superhero comics or fantasy when you're a kid, you think, it'd be great to be these characters. But Game of Thrones, the Marvel movies, all, you know, the Bourne movies show us how awful and hellish it would be to live in this world. And I think the genius of Killing Eve is it jams those two things together. It would be both brilliant and horrendous. You would have to become a monster to become that free individual, and that's the tension inside the Eve character that I find really, really fascinating.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. Soundtrack wise, it's this Torch Singers. It's not all The Unloved, a lot of the music is, but it's Torch Singers, it's all female vocalists. If we just had sort of Wham, or I don't know, Britpop on there, how much does it make the show?
I think that goes back to what you were saying. The colourful world depends on, you know, the soundtrack as well. And, you know, I think you said earlier on, Sean, that it's, you know, there's an Umbrellas of Cherbourg aspect to it. It's definitely true. It's no question, you know, and David Holmes is famously a massive record collector. And so you get all it's very deliberate references. But what I liked about it is that it wasn't too postmodern. It's not. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's like sort of showing the references. It's because this is the stuff that people love, you know, the people who making the program love, and so it just fits into that world. So yeah, I think it's that all that aspect. I think the plot. You're right. The plot. If you really analyze it, there's some ridiculous moments. I mean, okay, this is really nerdy, but there's an episode, I think it's the first episode of the new series, when the plot depends on this woman coming and sitting next to Eve at a Eurostar bar, and she says, can you move your bag, because I need to sit down. There's a row of empty seats next to her. Yeah. She could sit anywhere.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Well, she wants to get into conversation with Eve about being an addict. That's why.
Yes, yeah, so you remember that
bit.
Yeah,
so there might be. Yes, I do.
But still, that kind of... I was thinking, it doesn't work that way.
Quick mention for Julian Barrett is in the second episode, playing someone
called Julian. I thought that was really funny.
That's hilarious.
It went pure Julia Davis at that point. I thought they've really taken something from her work, I think, and put it in here. It's high camp.
Very suburban.
Episode two.
Yeah. Did you like that bit?
Yeah, that was one of the highlights for me. And I really liked how in that episode, well, in the first couple of episodes, really, Villanelle is, the way that you see her driven down, as you were saying, Will, is that she's not glamorous. Yeah. She's like wearing these like kind of drab clothes, and it's out of necessity, but that kind of shows her unravelling and how she's losing control, is that her hair is like, it's not even like she's wearing drab clothes and she's still got great hair. She's like got really drab hair. She's like really beaten down and fit, like her appearance wise. And that kind of makes her weak and makes her more malleable by this man that she's kind of got into.
She meets
somehow
her
got
match
into
in
thing.
A way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't tell me too much. I've only seen half that episode.
Okay.
Come on.
Oh,
right. I want to ask you, Claire, you've written a lot about mental health.
Yes.
And this is a picture of psychopathy and sociopathy and narcissism. Yeah. And she's got the full deck, actually, hasn't she, Villanelle?
She's got a lot. Yeah.
What do you think of it from that point of view? I mean, is it unfair to dramatise these things and make them into whiz-bang entertainment, or was it truthful? What did you think?
Well, I think that it is. I mean, I think that I would be loath to kind of diagnose people from a kind of what is quite a kind of
it's a heightened all dials environment.
Up heightened TV
yeah,
show.
She's quite atypical.
But I think that the thing that I like about the kind of and speaking as somebody who doesn't have any of the conditions that you just mentioned, but it's. A thing that I like about it is that it doesn't just show this as like living with mental illness as like a horrible thing. It's like, oh, actually, it can kind of, some of it can work to your benefit, even if it's one of these, like, you know, you, it's not all like horror, yeah. And you know, but it, some of it's quite fun, and that, and I kind of like that in a perverse way, you know.
Yeah, you too could be Charlotte Gainsbourg, serial killer.
Right, so, well, you've watched 4 episodes of this series.
I think so, yeah.
Claire's watched 4.
I've watched 4,
Andrew,
yeah.
You're
I've got
on...
1 and 2. I've watched 1.5 of the new series.
I've got 2.5. Fair to say we'll be watching it all, won't we?
I think
maybe
so.
Re-watching.
Definitely.
Going to complete that level, definitely. Let's have a bit of music. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune to dazzle and bewilder you, the listener. It's their editor's recommendation, in a manner of speaking. Claire Biddles, what have you brought in for us?
I brought in a song called Sometimes by Cubspot, who are an Australian band that I'm really obsessed with. Them.
More Australians? What else do we know about them? Or are they just like... excitingly unknown.
They're quite big in Australia. This is their third record, mm-hmm. but it's like the first record that they've made that's like a full on electronic pop album. And they're really kind of visibly queer, and they like their visuals are incredible as well. But yeah,
they're also
really...
quite audibly queer as well, aren't they?
Yes.
Let's have a listen to the visibly and audibly queer Cubspot with Sometimes.
Sometimes I feel like my heart has been split open. You see everything.
Okay, moving on. Since Prince passed away in 2016, his record labels have been relatively tasteful and restrained on the reissue front. There was a deluxe edition of Purple Rain, a fairly modest Greatest Hits, and last year's Ultra Unplugged Piano and a Microphone. Now comes Originals, featuring Prince's own recordings of songs made famous by other artists. It's got Manic Monday on it, as well as tunes later recorded by Sheila E., Apollonia 6, Vanity 6, and Kenny Rogers, amongst other people. Originals is out on June the 21st, but it's streaming right now on Tidal, and it's quite a good reason to try their 90-day free trial if you want to. Before we discuss the pros and cons of raiding the Prince Vault, here's probably the most famous of his songs that were recorded by another artist. Sung by Prince, here's Nothing Compares to You.
It's been 7 hours and 13 days since you took your love away.
Will Hutchinson, this is a weird one, isn't it? I mean, there are loads of demos and guide tracks here, but a Prince demo is better than most bands' finished stuff, isn't it? What did you make of it?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of songs that we all know, and we haven't heard these versions, or at least I've never heard these versions. I'd never heard the Prince original version of Nothing Compares to You. I'd never heard the Prince version of Manic Monday. And it reminded me, it made me think in a way of the Basement Tapes by the band, even though that album came out. But it was, you know, the idea with the Basement Tapes, they were for other people. And then eventually that got released. And this is a kind of similar thing. You know, these are, like you say, they're guide tracks. They're quite rough. I mean, there's a, you know, I think there's a big saxophone solo at the end of Nothing Compares to You. Mm. It's quite different. I mean, I really do have a weakness for this stuff. I love Prince. Some of it, first of all, it makes you realise how incredibly prolific he was. This was at the time when he was having huge, huge hit albums and he was producing these hits for other people. And also that his quality control wasn't always up there. So, you know, there's some really bad tracks on here.
You know, there's care to name any?
Well, yeah, there's a Kenny Rogers song called You're My Love, which is just a bad 1980s pop rock, you know, a kind of very cheap sort of tinny synthesizer backing track. There's a terrible rap called Holy Rock.
Holy Rock, that's a Christmas track, isn't it?
Holy Rock,
from the Crush Groove soundtrack.
That's
apparently.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Oh, and is that a Christmas song? That makes it more sense to me.
Yeah. In a way, it gets away with being bad because it's a Christmas song. But, you know, and then I didn't think the makeup by, I think it's Apollonia 6 was particularly good. But having said all of that, you know, the good songs I mean, nothing compares to you. I think that's one of the best songs ever written. Yeah. I think it's absolutely amazing.
And also, it's got the bit that's not on the Sinead O'Connor one, the do, 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 that sort of gigantic sort of mid-riff bit, because it's sort of stripped back.
There's also a fantastic song, which I must say I didn't know, which I think was a hit for Jill Jones, called Baby, You're a Trip, which is a really lovely bit of sort of, I guess, R&B, gospel soul.
Yeah.
And it's just great. And so the big question here, I mean, okay, so last week, Avicii, the EDM DJ who died, who, you know, killed himself, there was a bunch of his tracks were released, and I thought, I really didn't like it. I mean, all the money went to charity, but I just felt that it was, this is the world that killed him, and here he is back with this kind of unfinished, happy pop songs. And it, and that's when you get into the whole moral thing of releasing tracks posthumously. But I actually feel with Prince, you know, we all know about this massive vault of tracks. I felt that there's some value in this. There's value in these famous songs coming out, and these are good versions, interesting versions.
One thing I thought was interesting about it was, on the one hand, it's kind of tinny and scratchy and, you know, very sort of raw drum machines. But actually, that was the sound he was doing at the time. I remember when Sign of the Times came out and I thought, he hasn't produced this. How amazing. He's just like jacked it into the mixing desk, played it, bingo. There's, you know, his sort of, you know, he'd created overnight a sound of, you know, almost no reverb of any kind at all that was entirely him. Claire, are you a Prince fan? You're a follower?
Yeah, I love Prince. This was kind of interesting for me because I do love Prince, but I've not got like an encyclopedic knowledge of Prince. So this was, listening to this was quite interesting because it made me then cross-reference what he was doing at the time, and kind of, it was almost like it allowed me to kind of contextualise it a bit more and like kind of dive into stuff a bit more, because it does operate very strangely as an album. Because it has the kind of like traditional kind of like some more upbeat songs and some ballads and that kind of thing, but it stylistically it's kind of all over the place. I was interested in you, Will, saying that you didn't like the makeup song, because that was my highlight.
Oh really?
Yeah. I thought that was fascinating because it's that kind of like almost Kraftwerkian like. Minimalist electro and his voice, which is so used to, and the preceding few tracks are more kind of like what you think of Prince and his like kind of big voice and stuff. But this one is so restrained, and I loved that. And I also loved it in terms of, like, my favorite thing about Prince is his kind of how he works with gender and kind of It really worked for me as a kind of like him kind of in a way peacocking, talking about putting makeup on. And there's this great line where it's like, have a cigarette, I'm not ready yet, which I just loved. but it's like, it's kind of peacocking in a way that you're used to, but in a very restrained way. And I thought that was fascinating.
Also, he sings many lyrics that we're used to hearing from a female voice, particularly Manic Monday. And when Prince is singing, I was just in the middle of a dream, I was kissing Valentino by a crystal blue Italian stream. That's pretty modern, that, isn't it?
Yeah, Bangles I loved that. And it was so like, Manic Monday was more of his version was, I think, more of a curio for me, because I after listening to it, I was like, right, I still love the Bangles version a lot more. But it was hearing the kind of vulnerability in his voice in a different way than you're used to hearing men be vulnerable was just wonderful.
Another surprise about it is that none of these, they may be guide vocals, but they don't sound like guide vocals.
He
doesn't know how to sing badly, and he doesn't know how to not sing like Prince. So I'm imagining these people getting demo tracks and going, here's the guide vocal, and like, Jesus, I've got to sing that. How in the hell am I supposed to do that? Sean, what did you reckon?
I think I agree with Claire, and it's not an album as such. It's not really cohesive. It's very disjointed. I really like the beginning of it because I like Manic Monday. I think Makeup is the best song too.
Yes.
Sorry, Will. It's wonderful, and you see that side to him that sometimes gets glossed over and polished with a production behind it. The demo is really good. Remember, this is from The Vault, and The Vault's got thousands of songs. Mm. I mean, famously, this vault is stuffed with songs because he was so prolific and because he demoed everything before he would give it to other people. I think there's going to be much, much more of this. Do we need it? Well, I quite liked the idea that this is rough around the edges, but it gets into sleazy love boat territory, say, with the Kenny Rogers song. It just gets, you know, put it
sex
away.
Sex Shooter.
Put it away, yeah. Oh, I quite like Sex Shooter, because that's sort of performance, that's P-Funk. But, you know, it can get a bit Flashamack, which he did get, and it's just like, yeah,
that's
we
the
get
whole
that.
Point of Prince, Flashamack, is the whole...
Well, call me Prim, but I like it when he's suggests...
Her name is Prim, and she's not funky.
I like it when he suggests it rather than it's really overt.
Yeah.
It does remind you, just God, he was fucking brilliant. You know, it's so there's a lot of pop stars in the world, but you could really do it. You're really good at this.
Now you mentioned the Vault. I mean, what do we think about how the estate is handling this? Is it good, bad, tasteful? I think they've been pretty restrained.
Cover though, I think that you could have chosen a better cover. I mean, maybe young people don't look at covers anymore, but the cover of the record, it's like Prince Estate. He looks like a shoddy Michael Jackson. He's got
denim jacket. Really looks like a Michael Jackson cover.
Doesn't it?
Cover.
Like
it's
the bad cover or something, and he's got these funny bits on his jacket, and you think you could have dressed up.
When I walk down to bloody Tesco's in Dalston, I see 500 kids who look exactly like that. It's going to hit the spot with those in the immensely fashionable
in London's
part,
trendy Stoke Newton.
In London's trendy London. Yeah.
I just think it's a bad foot. I mean, there's a lot of hot pictures of Prince.
Yeah, they could have chosen the better one.
There are no
but
pictures of Prince
badly.
That are not hot. Do we is it the case that you can only actually do this with Prince because there isn't anybody else who's got a comparable kind of archive, huge reservoir of stuff? I mean, you're not going to be able to do this with
Jesus
and
Mary Chain. Jesus Mary, no.
You can't do this with the Pigeon Detectives.
But you know, that's in a way that's sad because Prince was weird because he had that golden phase, which probably lasted for about a decade, I'd say. And then after that, he didn't really have any hits. You know, once he's past the Warners period, he didn't really have hits again. And actually, there's a hell of a lot of really bad albums that came out, you know, like cover mounts on the Daily Mail and, you know, kind of weird MP3 albums. And a lot of those were, they'd have moments, but they, you know, the quality control was sort of out, you know, wasn't there anymore. And in a sense, it's a shame that Prince has got so much stuff in the vault because a lot of it won't be that great. I think I personally like this one because, like we were saying before, because these are famous songs and it's fascinating to hear their roots. But there's going to be a lot of stuff that isn't so good.
You don't necessarily want the expanded version of Rave On 2, The Joy Fantastic.
No, you're going to get it, or the Rainbow Children and stuff. You know,
I always thought that Prince's big problem in the 90s and the 90s was musical incontinence. He just needed somebody to go, no, just don't do that. These 30 songs, let's choose 6 of them. That kind of thing.
Yeah, he didn't have a manager. He didn't have, not a real manager. He didn't have a record label. He didn't have anyone to tell him not to release things and not do things, you know. So he was his own boss.
Yeah. And we all know how terrible that can be. But overall, we liked it, didn't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Overall, it's a jolly good idea. And you get, funnily enough, you get the Tidal subscription, don't you? The 90 days coinciding. So, kids.
Get out of there. This podcast is brought to you by Tidal.
No, but I mean, that's sort of canny of them to have wrapped it up like that. It's a bit like a Daily Mail cover mount CD for now.
It is, yes.
Right. Okay, it's Will Hodgkinson's turn to choose a tune for us. What have you brought in, Will?
I have chosen Slushy by Surfboard.
And what is that?
Okay, well, Surfboard, we're talking about Amyl and the Sniffers. They're almost like the sister group to Amyl and the Sniffers. The lead singer is this incredible woman called Danny Miller. And she's young, but all the guys in the band are sort of pushing 50. They're all a bunch of old punks from Texas.
Right.
She's this young woman from, I think she's from LA, but they're all based in Brooklyn now. Mm-hmm. They all met at a party. And it's just a great... I'm going to be honest with you, I've got very... quite an immature mind and also sort of quite basic tastes, and it's just basic silly Ramon style punk rock with this fantastic hilarious woman fronting them. And Slushy, I think it really is about the ice drink Slushy. I think that's the inspiration, and all the songs are about things like that. And so it's just so Surfboard, they're just this new wave of kind of really fun. And also Amyl and Sniffers and Surfboard did a campaign for Gucci, and you know, these were down on their luck punks.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, one step away from being homeless, and then they're on the Gucci campaign.
Well,
I just
homeless,
love that.
But they've got nice clothes to wear.
They've got nice clothes.
Let's listen to Surfboard with Slushy.
Go away.
Finally, I Am Mother, the latest of Netflix's... It is the latest of Netflix's cerebral sci-fi movies featuring Hilary Swank and the voice of Rose Byrne. Humankind has been wiped out again. There's only one female child left on the planet and she's being raised by a maternal artificial intelligence. How does this female-led sci-fi picture fit into the Ursula K. Le Guin tradition of speculative fiction about gender and what makes humans human? And is it any good? This is what it sounds like.
Why aren't there any more children, Mother?
There used to be.
Then why did you only make one?
Mothers need time to learn. This facility was designed to give humanity a second chance. One that began with you. Daughter. The path will not be easy. The world outside is lifeless. But I made you into the woman that you are so that we could do this together.
Mother? How are you infected? By the contagion outside.
Who put that in your head?
Did you know there were people out there?
I'm as surprised as you.
There's a droid here.
Mother's not what you think. She's taken care of me my whole life.
Now let's see how they've done.
Not Mother.
Some mothers do incubate them in an underground facility. This is very much in the mould of the 1970s capsule sci-fi movie, like a Logan's Run job. Claire Biddles, is this the sort of thing that you're into? You've got a very sparkly coat on. It makes me think you would be.
Yeah, I like a lot of sci-fi stuff. And this was kind of interesting in not more in how it kind of slots into a kind of trajectory of these kind of insular, like you say, insular kind of sci-fi films. I recently watched and loved Claire Denis's High Life. I don't know if anybody else saw that, but that was another one where it was kind of, in this case, two people stuck on a spaceship and one of them's a child, and like how does humanity grow in a place where there's no other humans? So I was kind of interested to see this so quickly after that and how differently this approached it, but this was much more of a kind of like straight down the line kind of sci-fi film. But I thought that it was fun and enjoyable and predictable, but it kind of did what it did quite well. I thought the performances were pretty good.
There's only really two performances, Mother, the robot, is actually motion captured by a man and voiced by Rose Byrne.
Oh, really?
And Hilary Swank is the woman who breaks into this sealed underground, or is admitted into the underground facility where daughter has been raised, and she is the kind of thing that breaks the world and opens up everything that we learn in. You know, I don't think it's giving too much away to say that there are a series of twists. It's also one big Bechdel test, isn't it? I don't think anybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's like one male character, very, very, very briefly.
Yeah, I was obviously glad to see that. I'm not sure if it was. Do you know if it was written by a woman? Or
I think it was written by a man and directed by a man.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Because that's kind of. I can't remember something else that I've seen recently where it was like an all-female cast, and Suspiria, the Luca Guadagnino film, who one of my favourite directors, but that was kind of all women, but everybody behind the scenes was men, and that I was kind of thinking of that again, where it's like it kind of had a kind of again comparing it to High Life, it kind of had a sterility to it that High Life didn't, which was directed by a woman, written by a woman, and which was a lot more kind of unexpected.
Although, to be fair, it is about a sterile environment, and it's about a very sterile version of motherhood. In fact, it is, in a way, it is about motherhood and what is human, because we see Mother, the robot, kind of sort of hothousing daughter with not just physically but educationally and also morally, in terms of moral decisions about what's right, and which becomes grows as part of the theme. But I don't know, but I mean, maybe Sean, you have some input on this as well. What do you think it says about motherhood? Has he got things to say about motherhood?
Yes, it has. It's got about the burden of care that you have. I mean, you are. I mean, I think it goes quite deep in that sense. What makes a good parent, and how do you produce a child that's not going to fuck it all up?
Yeah,
I thought it had a lot in common with Moon, which is about insular, yeah. And suddenly there's another twist, and there's another twist. Really cheap to make. You've got a couple of actors in it, and you've got a set. I mean, not too much of a way that you're going to be on location, that sort of thing. So in a way, it does it very well. I think Netflix doing B movies really well. I think this is
it's a wonderful B movie. Yeah.
And the idea that sort of Sarah Connor from Terminator 2 comes in, and what do you do when a real character comes in with this very sterile environment? I would say, though, Hilary Swank, as much as I respect her, I thought her acting was awful. I thought she overacts that whole thing, and that started to ruin it for me.
She was dying of sepsis at one point. That's kind of...
Yes, but there's a lot of gurning from Swank, but that's me being niggly.
Did you ever think that there should be a version 2.0 of Mother, which instead of being so careful and nurturing, says things like, go away and play Minecraft, leave me alone, I'm busy,
yes.
Go on your bike.
As mother's on Instagram and child is wailing
for the clock. Mum's
exactly.
9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Is this kind of thing part of your usual diet? Would you watch it if I said, let's do this?
I might watch it, yes. I did really enjoy it. I can't say that I didn't. But I did feel it had its limitations. Sorry. Mm.
Will, you've got kids.
I have got kids.
Could you relate to this? Could you relate to I Am Mother?
Did you incubate them in an underground bunker?
Well, I tried, but they escaped very, very early on. I thought it was a fantastic idea. A great idea. What is a robot capable of? You know, that's what it is to me. It's really, for me, it's about artificial intelligence. And, you know, what does that mean? All that kind of stuff. I really liked the beginning, and what I felt, again, I don't want to give too much away, but essentially the world beyond the bunker and beyond the robot is going to crash in on daughter. And I kind of thought, well, hang on a sec. If you had been so incubated that you've never even seen another human being in the flesh, you're going to have more extreme reactions.
I thought that as well.
And I got very frustrated. So I kind of felt, oh, this is setting it up for an amazing experience, because clearly we're not just going to stay here, or we're not just going to stay in this one robot, one daughter world. And when that came, I felt it was a missed opportunity, because I thought, I was just, you know, going all the things that go into your head. You know, it's a bit like, it reminded me of, I remember when I was a kid, you'd hear these stories about children who'd been raised by wolves and stuff like this. You never knew if they were true or not, but you always wondered what it was like when they went into the world, or the Enigma of Caspar Hauser and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, that is just waiting for some amazing things. But actually, the girl's just carried on as before.
Well, the weird thing is, we do see how she has been raised in isolation but immersed in culture. So she watches the Johnny Carson show.
That's very different, though, for me.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. They try to set it up in the sense that, like, well, she won't be so traumatised because she's been in she knows what another human being looks like, but it takes more than the Johnny Carson show to make you capable of dealing with another human being.
You know, in a way, it's quite a good analogy for how people are living their lives these days, when everything is on screen and people staring at screen, but they've still got to deal with reality.
Well, that's what I thought it was. It was a metaphor for growing up with technology. It's a metaphor for growing up with those very sterile images, and what do you do when the real world does happen? And I don't think it's a mistake that she is just post-pubescent. You know, she's obviously...
I think that's a good point.
Yeah.
Also, this happens...
childhood.
And it's also her phase of teenage rebellion.
Yeah.
It's like finally, you know, actualising yourself. I thought I enjoyed it. I was slightly disappointed that the kind of turn the film took was to explain the world and explain the situation of the bunker and to explain everything behind it, rather than to delve into that psychological issue of what is it like when you are raised by a machine,
which that's what I wanted
to me
of.
Is more interesting. It slightly became a... it became a B movie rather than a Black Mirror or a 2000 AD Future Shock, which is what I kind of wanted.
I thought Daughter was just a bit like the good girl at school who gets all her grades. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I thought, no, hang on a sec. You know, okay, you've got a pushy mum and dad who like made you do extra French lessons. You're brought up by a robot. You're not going to be like that.
But I think this does lays the groundwork for in 3 or 4 years' time for a kind of a Dark Star version. You know, the way Dark Star is a take on Alien, it's a comedy take on Alien. It actually precedes Alien, funnily enough. the Dark Star is like how boring it would be to be flying a spaceship around blowing up planets, and what you would do, you amuse yourself with a rubber chicken or like playing beer pong or whatever. And then they remade it as a serious film as Alien, what would it be like to be trapped on a spaceship? I think there's an opportunity here to do, what would it really be like to be raised by robots, with like dad robot reading the robot paper and mum robot saying you never do anything around here, you know, to redo all those cliches in a comic way.
Futurama?
Kind of is, yeah. Live-action Futurama. Mm-hmm. I kind of enjoyed it, but it's basically a 12-inch Black Mirror episode, isn't it, really? Mm-hmm. There's not enough psychological truth in there.
Great idea.
It's a really, really good idea.
Yeah.
Worth watching, though. Mm. Okay, well, before we go,
I believe, Andrew, you've got a track to play.
I brought in a track to play, because why not? This is Plaid, P-L-A-I-D, who are a techno duo, and they used to be in The Black Dog. Remember The Black Dog? Who produced a load of records for... Sean's looking blankly at me. No, they produced a load of records for Björk, quite big on the techno scene.
Really?
Plaid have been going for years and years and years. I don't think they get anywhere near the credit they deserve. They make beautiful, mad, strange, ornate, clever, funny, memorable, rhythmic... love beautifully textured techno music. They've done a few film soundtracks. It's all instrumental, and they've got some new stuff out now. This track is called Dancers. I believe it's a single. I don't really know, but it just popped up on my new release radar thing on Spotify, and I went, oh good, Plaid have got a record out, and it's really great. So we're going to have a listen. This is Plaid with Dancers. The end of the show is looming interview, and that means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a vicious cocktail while Villanelle breaks into the house and demands a drink at knife point?
And then snogs you
yeah. while shoving me in the bath. Claire Biddles, what's your closing time chatter for the show?
I kind of wanted to maybe talk about something that happened came out yesterday, was the destruction of all the kind of master tapes.
Yes, this is an astonishing story, isn't it?
Yeah. And I kind of like briefly saw it yesterday when I was like looking through Twitter and presumed that it was something that had happened now or like was currently happening. The kind of destruction of all these master tapes. I can't remember what record company it was.
I think it was Universal and Warner. Yeah. So they've been storing their master tapes. Basically, it's a long piece, which we will post on Facebook for the listeners, about how... master tapes have just been treated with derision for years and years, shunted around, dumped in kind of outsourced storage facilities with all of the metadata taken off. So you'll never stumble upon an amazing jazz performance. You'll never find these fantastic outtakes. Mm. And it's like our huge chunk of our musical cultural heritage has just been not exactly destroyed, but just kind of lost somewhere.
Yeah. And it kind of made me think, well, because I was also listening to the Prince record that we were discussing today, and it kind of made me think, God, that is something that Prince was obviously kind of in control of his, all of his work, and this huge vault that we were saying that apparently he was the only person who had like the passcode to it, but maybe that was written somewhere after he died. But once you put that in control of somebody else, how that kind of huge swathes of musical heritage can just be neglected. And it was a really sad story for me, and more so because it kind of stretched back over years and years.
It's also quite fascinating about how this situation has arisen because of the way that the executives that run record companies are often not from a music background.
Yeah,
and they will say things like, what is mastering?
Yeah.
And they'll say, you can make a compilation CD. Look, here it is. I've made it with a bunch of MP3s, 192. Here you go, we can put that out, that kind of thing. And the idea that you can't, you know, to remaster anything for currently existent or future formats, you actually need the original tapes.
And absolutely. Those tapes are amazing. And presumably band has to get themselves out of a contract or buy back those tapes if they want to archive their masters as well. It's about the record companies.
It even goes down to the level of, like, the perishability of sellotape is going to cause, you know, vast swathes of stuff to vanish.
Well, at least it's perishable and not around forever.
Yeah, but then what about John Coltrane, man?
Recycling.
Is that what they bake tape? Is that what they mean when they bake them?
In order to bake the tape, you've got to find the tape. Baking the tapes, you can do it once to rebond the oxide or whatever it is, and then you have to transfer it digitally or transfer it to another format. But even that, what about in the future when a new thing comes around and you've destroyed the tape by baking it?
Oh, sometimes art is destructive, MG Harrison.
Yeah,
yeah, come on.
Yeah, your pop nihilism.
Yeah,
Will Hutchinson, what's your closing time chatter?
Mine is the Rolling Thunder Review, which is Martin Scorsese's new film on Bob Dylan's tour, which was in 75, 76. And I've seen I recommend anyone to go and see it. It's absolutely fascinating. But I've seen Dylan a few times, and it's always been really, really disappointing. You know, it's been a very, not really a show at all. And, you know, he famously mangles his old songs and everything. So I kind of assumed that he'd just been like that since the 60s. But he was absolutely incredible in the footage in Rolling Thunder Review. But also it's a very interesting documentary because it's kind of a fake documentary.
Right.
So it's presented as real, but it turns out that there are actors in there playing roles. There's a guy who said that he filmed the whole thing who seems very suspicious. And so Scorsese, and you know, Dylan is very famous for obfuscating his own past. Scorsese is played along with him. He's kind of he's come along for this game where you don't know what's true and what isn't. But what you do see is the reality of Dylan being absolutely electric, you know, so good. At this period when he was going through a divorce, he was writing these long songs which were had a narrative, you know, songs like Tangled Up in Blue. And it's just fantastic. And there's one moment which is incredible where I really like Joni Mitchell. And I really love her album, Hejira, and I really love the first song in it, which is called Coyote. And she is playing the song in a hotel room for the first time with a bunch of other people. I think maybe even Roddy Wood's there. There's kind of a random bunch of people. Gordon Lightfoot, I think Dylan's there. Roger McGuinn, maybe. And
are you there in your guise as Al Cooper?
Yeah, obviously.
With your lovely amazing glasses on, yeah.
That goes without saying. But it's, you know, you're hearing this song for the first... They're hearing it for the first time. It's a bit like what we were saying about the Prince thing. It sounds like the finished version. It's such an incredibly good song. So clever. And, you know, I kind of think Joni Mitchell was actually better than Dylan. I think she was definitely a better musician, no question. Equally a good songwriter.
Mm. I agree.
So it's kind of nice to have her in there.
So, yeah, Joni up, Dylan down. Fair enough. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, this show seems to be brought to you by unreleased originals and demo tapes, isn't it? I'm just going to chat about the Radiohead, the Hacker, because I think they stored their stuff on the cloud.
Oh, hey, sorry. You, get off of my cloud.
They stored their stuff on the cloud and some hacker got 18 hours worth of OK Computer demos and went, if you don't give me $150,000, I'm going to release them. And they went, we'll release them instead. It's so Radiohead. I mean, how 100% Radiohead can you get?
None more Radiohead.
Oh, absolutely. They have just Radiohead.
That's their cloud password.
None more Radiohead.
They are so on brand. And so they've released it. It's available for 18 days. It will be less now after we've gone out. It costs 18 quid to get 18 hours worth of Radiohead demos, if you should want such a thing. And they're giving all the money to Extinction Rebellion. It just gets more Radiohead and Radiohead.
Yeah.
And you just think, good on you, actually. I could be cynical, but I think good on
I
you.
I think it's a good idea.
Don't store your stuff on the cloud, bands. That's a really stupid idea.
I think it's a good idea.
Google Docs.
Except I've got to write a piece on the New Statesman for it tomorrow. I've got to listen to 18 hours of Radiohead.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know people say writers, they don't really listen to the records. I'm going to hold my hand up. I can't really listen to 18 hours of this. I've got to write about the bits I can get through.
Impossible.
Technically impossible.
You've got to do it by
tomorrow. Like 2 hours of fitter, happier, like slightly different AI voices.
Maybe there'll be some jokes in it. I don't know.
I was going through some of it yesterday. I mean, it's you know, it is fascinating. That's the thing, you know, and you're listening to it. And I'm not really a big Radiohead fan, but, you know, you're seeing how all this stuff comes about.
Mm.
It's a bit like the
Prince
stuff.
It takes the magic away, though, does it, a little bit?
Well,
because it's about the construction, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. But I think it was... I also had to say, God, hats off to them, you know, because it's a bit like Brian Wilson with, you know, Pet Sounds and then Smile, you know, hearing all this stuff. You just think, wow, they really, really, they were very virtuosic musicians. Mm. And they just thought, right, it's the kind of a very good creative way where you just create loads and loads and loads of stuff.
Mm.
loads of times and then edit it and then finally shape it and shape it and shape it until you got what you want.
I'm just hoping there's going to be some trog tapes bit in the middle, you know, with, you know, Colin going, for fuck's sake, do it properly! I know. My closing time chatter, it's a bit of a sad one, but I'm going to ring the bell for RIP for Andy Gill of Q on Mojo fame. He was a great writer. He also wrote loads for us on the Word magazine in those glory days, and he passed away at the weekend. Andy was an absolute Dylan expert, and he was a mainstay of the early days of Q and Mojo. I didn't like the music that he liked, but I liked him a lot. He was a really talented bloke and a really, you know, entertaining bloke to be around, and it is a terrible, terrible shame. So RIP Andy Gill. Also, the other Andy Gill from Gang of Four. He actually met the other Andy Gill, finally.
There's a photo, isn't there?
They were confused for years and years and years and years, and then they met up for a feature in the Independent, which is available on that internet. So you should have a look at that. It's very funny. RIP Andy Gill.
And that's the end of the show. Thanks to Claire Biddles and Will Hodgkinson for coming in. Will, what's your next exciting writing assignment?
I am going to interview a woman called Rhiannon Giddens, who used to be in a band called the Carolina Chocolate Drops. And she's American, but she now lives in Ireland. So I'm going there tomorrow. And she is, I guess she's unusual in that she's an African-American folk artist, and you know, folk and country and all these bluegrass, it's a very white dominated world. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of reclaiming its roots.
Excellent. She'll be a good night to have a good night. Amel and the Sniffers.
I think she's I think she's like a kind of, you know, sort of, she's got PhDs and things. So I've got a feeling that she's
You're
quite serious.
Hang one on. Okay, yeah. Fine. Claire, what are you up to next?
Next is, so me and my friend Stuart are putting together a fanzine about REM that we've been wanting to do for about 4 years now, but we're finally doing it this summer. So
is it going to be called Staples of the Reconstruction? Because it should be.
Oh my God, it should be.
There you go.
That's incredible.
Amazing. Will and Claire are going to stay around for the extra bit in which, for no special reason, we will name the most overrated and underrated films of all time. In the meantime, thanks for listening from me, Andrew, and producer Sophie Black. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.